When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, Farah. I can't believe we've come to the final episode of our series.
It has been a journey. And actually, our listeners may be interested to know that this episode was, in fact, the first one that we recorded way back in February.
Yes, this was recorded in person before COVID-19 disrupted our lives and made meeting in person possible forevermore and delayed the launch of this podcast series. So we should note that this was before Keir Starmer was appointed leader of the Labour Party and before Rachel was reappointed to the Shadow Cabinet as Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster.
And in the theme of today's episode, our quickfire round is about political leaders, which may be our most controversial round yet. Merkel or Macron?
I work for a French company, so it's got to be Macron.
Barack or Michel?
I'd like to say Michelle, but we've got a bit of a beef, Michelle and I, because we had a book out at the same time, and I feel like she stole my thunder a bit, which I think was a bit unnecessary.
Brilliant. All right, well, someone that definitely didn't steal your thunder, Churchill or Attlee?
Got to go with Churchill. Saved the world.
Greece or Rome?
I presume we're talking about as existed 2,000 years ago.
Yes, empires.
I'm going to go Greece, mainly because the Roman Empire copied everything off the Greeks.
Robin Hood or the Sheriff of Nottingham?
Well, as a very law-abiding citizen, I've always thought the Sheriff of Nottingham had a very bad rap, so I'm going with the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Controversial. And Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great?
Julius Caesar, I think, genuinely changed the world, and a lot of the things that Caesar did, started, created, we see their echoes today. And you can't say that about many people who were born 2,000 years ago.
I'm Chris Hurst, and this is the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast, powered by Intelligence Squared. Joining me today is Labour MP Rachel Reeves. Rachel has an impressive and varied career, initially as an economist at the Bank of England, then declining a role at Goldman Sachs, becoming MP for Leeds West in 2010. She's the former Shadow Secretary of State for Worker Pensions. She's also the author of the fascinating and recently published Women of Westminster, The MPs Who Changed Politics. And to top it all off, at age 14, was the girls' UK chess champion.
So that was Rachel, the high point.
The high point, exactly. In three words, only three words, describe your leadership style.
Never give up.
If you could delete any word from the leadership bullshit jargon dictionary, what would it be?
Sorry when they don't mean it.
Yeah. Best decision you've ever made?
To stand for Parliament.
Which political leader do you most admire? Could be present, past.
Barbara Castle.
And why?
Because she was responsible for the Equal Pay Act, for child benefit, and so many other policies that transformed women's lives.
Who is the best Prime Minister we've never had or haven't had yet?
Harriet Harman.
Fantastic. So, Rachel, what persuaded you to leave banking for politics? Was it the money?
Well, I always had a love for politics and making change. I joined the Labour Party when I was at school because I grew up under 18 years of Conservative government, and I didn't feel that those governments represented me or people like me in the community that I grew up in. And so I felt that politics had the power to change things. And so it was always sort of my hobby, really. It's something I did at weekends, and I went to conferences and the rest of it. But my day job was working in banking and financial services. And then a opportunity came to stand for Parliament, and I seized that opportunity because as much as I loved my roles, particularly at the Bank of England, and also I worked for a while at the British Embassy in Washington, it was politics that really drove me.
And what does leadership in politics mean to you? And is it different to the leadership you saw and experienced in business?
I guess the first form of leadership in politics is at a local level. So you're leading volunteers and activists to go out and campaign and make the case in your community. And that's a different type of leadership because you can't motivate people by the offers of increase in pay or a promotion because there aren't those sorts of offers to be made. And so you're really inspiring people by your ideas, by your party's manifesto, by your personal brand, that someone wants you to be their MP in their community. An MP, when I was standing, said this to me the first time, you've got to have people in your local community who would be really proud to say, Rachel is our MP, and I know Rachel, I've worked for her. And so there is a sort of a personal loyalty that you've got to build up. But motivating volunteers is quite different, I think, from motivating people in a sort of traditional workplace. And then there's the leadership in Westminster that you have to provide. And as you say, I served in the Shadow Cabinet when Ed Miliband was leader of the Labour Party. And, you know, I thought that, you know, there was a possibility that we could form a government and that would have been a different type of leadership again. But I then had to make a really difficult decision in 2015 to stand down from the Shadow Cabinet because I didn't support the direction that the party was going in under new leadership under Jeremy Corbyn. And so I made a decision actually at that point to step back because I didn't feel I could lead in the direction the party was going.
Do you think there's a difference between winning elections and the skills you have to have to win elections and leading the country?
Well, actually, if you look at, the leaders of my party, the Labour Party, you know, they were successful at winning elections. Clement Attlee won 2, Harold Wilson won, I think, 4, and Tony Blair won 3. So they were good at winning elections, but actually, I think all of them were pretty good at governing as well. And if you look back to their legacy as well, you know, 1945, Clement Attlee got elected to the National Health Service, the welfare state, his two proudest legacies, and they are still, by and large, with us today, particularly the National Health Service, probably our most treasured institution as a nation. Harold Wilson created the Open University, introduced comprehensive education, and actually the social liberal reforms around abortion, gay rights, race relations, they came in under the leadership of Harold Wilson and under Tony Blair, the national minimum wage, the tax credit system to lift people out of poverty, and our schools and hospitals rebuilt. So they were good at winning elections, but actually, all those years on, you can still point to the legacies of those prime ministers.
And for me, one of the things we learn as we learn to be leaders is we learn from good leaders, but also we learn from bad leaders. You know, we learn different lessons. And in some ways, you know, if I look at my own experiences, I've probably learned as much from it was more painful, but I've learned as much from the people I considered to be bad leaders as good. I mean, can you relate to that? Does that relate through into politics?
Of course it does. And, you know, if you look back to the Conservative leaders, you know, when I was first getting involved in politics, of William Hague and Ian Duncan Smith in the late 90s and early 2000s, both of them retreated to the base of their party. Yeah. It was very blue-blooded conservatism. It was focused on a very narrow range of issues. Actually, you know, William Hague, it was 24 hours to save the pound. You know, we're going to go into the euro, which we didn't, under Tony Blair. And even, actually, Michael Howard, remember those adverts, are you thinking what we're thinking?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
It was dog-whistle politics, appealing to the conservative base. And the lesson from that is, to win, you need to build broad coalitions.
Yep.
Of course, you've got to keep your base with you. And actually, Labour's lost some of its base, hasn't it? Those northern working-class constituencies. You've got to keep your base, absolutely. Don't neglect them.
To that point, sorry to cut across you, but do you think, is Labour losing its base, or is the fundamental, you know, the division, if that's the right word, that we've had in our politics for, let's say, since the Second World War, maybe longer, is that division changing? I mean, are the dividing lines now different to where they were?
Well, that's what it looks like. And actually, that's the direction that's happened in the United States.
Yes.
I don't want that to be the division here. You know, the Labour Party is called the Labour Party for a reason. It's the party of work, but it's supposed to represent working people in industry, new industries and old industries. And actually, we've lost our heart, I think, if we've lost those communities and those people and those traditions. But actually, they feel culturally quite distant from the Labour Party at the moment. And the Labour Party, I think, needs to start focusing a little bit more on the everyday issues that affect people's lives.
But do you think that's value? Do you think that's at least partly values?
Yes,
do you think they see the Labour Party's values as being different to their values to an extent?
Yes, I think that's the problem. And I think a sort of relentless focus on ideology and on some of those cultural issues rather than the bread and butter issues that affect people's lives. Like, you know, what do people want? They want work that offers them a decent wage with some security and dignity. They want strong communities where and places where they feel at home. You know, some of the debate we're having at the moment about the decline of towns. You know, what's Labour got to say about that? And they want their families to be supported. And Labour have sort of stopped using that everyday language of family, community and place.
So, of course, you want the answer to this question to be a Labour leader. But what sort of leader do you want the country to have now? And is that... is that different to when you entered politics?
The challenges facing the country today are so different to those that ushered Tony Blair into Downing Street in 1997. You know, we are such a divided country today. The Brexit referendum, in a way, unleashed politics that we hadn't experienced in this country before and has, you know, in many ways, I think, torn us apart. I think there is a real desire to unite the country. My friend Jo Cox, when she made her maiden speech in Parliament, said we have more in common than that which divides us. And actually, that was Jo's approach to politics. And it wasn't, if I'm honest, my approach to politics when I got elected. I was much more tribal than that. And, you know, a number of things, a referendum, Jeremy Corbyn winning the leadership of the Labour Party and Jo's death made me reassess my approach to politics. And I have, over the last 3.5 years since she was murdered, try and learn some lessons from her style of leadership and the way she approached politics.
And so do you think one of the ways that we... as a nation can heal this division is we have to start by, to an extent, healing the division in within the Houses of Parliament? I mean, do we need to be less tribal there?
I think there is a lot of really fantastic examples of when parliamentarians across the political spectrum do work together. And actually, in the book that I wrote, Women of Westminster, a lot of that is about some of the work across parties to champion the causes.
I mean, you pull that through throughout the book.
Yes, and it was one of the most inspiring bits about doing the research for that book is some of those struggles that women in the country and women in Parliament led to get change for women in the country.
Which, so, I guess, because there was... I mean, there still is relative, there's more, but there's still fewer women. But in then, there was so many fewer women.
Yeah, so 100 years ago.
They had to form coalitions, I suppose.
Yeah, 100 years ago, there was just one woman in Parliament. And for 2 years, almost, Nancy Astor, a Conservative MP, was the only woman in Parliament out of 650 MPs. Today, from the most recent election in December 2019, there are 220 women.
More Labour women MPs, am I right?
Yes. And more than half of the parliamentary Labour Party are women, which is a fantastic achievement. But it's still the case that there's almost twice as many men in Parliament as there are women. But what a change in the last century to go from one to 220 today. But the story of the early women, particularly in Parliament, was working together. And Nancy Astor was asked by her party, the Conservative Party, to campaign in a by-election for her party against the Liberals. But the Liberals had selected a woman, Margaret Winteringham, in the seat. And Nancy Astor refused to go and campaign in that by-election and said, no, we need more women in Parliament from every political persuasion.
I'm not sure that would happen now.
No, maybe it wouldn't. But she recognised that she couldn't alone represent the views and the interests of all women in the country. And those women, Winteringham and Astor, and then joined by people like Ellen Wilkinson and Margaret Bonfield from the Labour Party, championed together issues that affected women. So, for example, the first piece of what was described as feminist legislation was on the equal guardianship of children. And until the mid-1920s, in the case of separation or divorce, mothers had no rights over their children whatsoever. The children were the property of the father.
Yeah.
And Margaret Winteringham stood up in Parliament and made this really brilliant speech where she urged the men in Parliament to do a mental somersault and put themselves in the position where they desperately desired the custody of their own child but were denied it. And they managed to change the law so that for the first time, women had equal guardianship of their children.
I get a great sense of what drives you. What gives you a sense of achievement? How do you know when, you know, I kind of, we were joking when we walked in, I kind of know if I go home at night whether I've done a good job that day or a bad job that day. How does that work if you're an MP?
I think that the constituency link is really important. And actually, you know, I've been an MP for almost 10 years now. All of those 10 years have been in opposition, and it can at times be very dispiriting because the manifestos I've stood on at four elections still sit on the drawing board and never to be implemented, it seems. But at a local level, because of the austerity that we've faced over the last 10 years, there have been lots of threats of cuts to public services, to local services. And we haven't managed to save all of those. But there is a swimming baths in my constituency, Bramley Baths, that wouldn't be open today if I hadn't have worked with the community to protect that. And now it's owned by the community as a community asset. There's a new train station in Leeds, the first new train station in Leeds for 30 years, Kirkstall Forge in my constituency, a former engineering works. And that's now being redeveloped into housing and businesses. And again, I worked with the
it's
local council and developers.
Change.
Yes, to get that change in my community. At a national level, going back again to my friend Jo Cox, when she died, she was working on a number of projects. And one of them was to tackle loneliness and social isolation in all of our communities. And she was working, as she did, with a Conservative MP to deliver that change. And that Conservative MP, Seema Kennedy, approached me and asked if I would take forward Jo's work because she knew we were good friends. And I did that. And Theresa May, who was Prime Minister at the time, accepted the recommendations of our report and our manifesto for tackling loneliness. And the UK has the first ever Minister for Loneliness and a strategy for tackling loneliness, which make a huge difference, particularly to older people. But actually, Jo said that young or old, loneliness doesn't discriminate. And so you can make a difference even from opposition if you work together to deliver change.
Well, it's a fantastic segue, because my next question actually is, you know, leadership is often considered to be a lonely place. Do you ever feel overwhelmed?
You're definitely exposed because, you know, everything that you say and do is open to public scrutiny, and nothing you ever say is going to be off the record or taken to be your personal view. And so, you know, it's a huge privilege, but with that privilege comes huge, I think, responsibility as well. Again, particularly at a local level, because you're never not the MP for your local area. Mm. So on Boxing Day 2015, there were serious floods in my constituency. I was at home with my family, and you know, the news came that the Kirkstall Road in Leeds West was underwater. And so, you know, it was Boxing Day, but the next morning we were out in that community, literally cleaning up the mess. And so, you know, you're always an MP, you are exposed, and it can be a lonely place. But actually, I think my approach to leadership has always been quite collaborative. And certainly, you know, the things I'm proudest of, on saving Bramley Baths, on getting the new train station, and on loneliness, other people can also take credit for those victories and those successes, and that's a good thing. And actually, you wouldn't get that change unless you work with people, either your community or with other MPs, to deliver it. And that, I guess, is my approach to change, and I think that's how you get lasting change as well.
In your 10 years then, what has been your most difficult decision?
My most difficult decision was to stand down from the Shadow Cabinet in 2015. I'd worked incredibly hard for Ed, and I'd worked incredibly hard during the general election. In the general election, I was 8 months pregnant, expecting my second child. And after the leadership election, I had to make a decision about whether I wanted to carry on in the Shadow Cabinet and go straight back to work when my youngest was just 3 months old, or whether, because I hadn't backed Jeremy Corbyn to be leader, whether I wanted to take a step back and do something different. And I made that decision to take a step back. But then unleashed upon me was a huge amount of criticism and abuse, again, from people on my own side. And I was called a red Tory. You know, why didn't I just go and join the Conservative Party? Just because I had some reservations about the direction the Labour Party was going in. And the Labour Party no longer felt like a broad church. I felt very exposed, actually more exposed then than I did when I was perhaps in the leadership position of the Shadow Cabinet.
You write in your book about how women in politics have been treated through the years, and that you certainly have plenty of examples of arguably women receive more hostility. All politicians receive hostility, women receive even more hostility. Has that been your experience, and do you think it's getting better, getting worse? You know, what needs to be done about it?
So I certainly think that the sort of lessons from history is that, you know, women are perhaps more exposed mm-hmm. and held to higher standards, actually, than the male counterparts are. And Nancy Astor, the first woman to take her seat in Parliament, put it very well. And she said, pioneers are picturesque figures, but they're often very lonely ones. And I think that was very much her experience. Yeah. She also said that the men in Parliament would have rather had a rattlesnake in the chamber rather than her. And I think she was almost certainly right, because she was beginning to break up this all-male cosy club that had existed for hundreds of years. Now, in the book, I try and reflect on the changes to women in Parliament. Now, there's a lot more of us today. Harriet Harman, when she was first elected in 1982, said that there was a sisterhood in the country, you know, watching out for her, looking out for her, but there wasn't a sisterhood in Parliament because there were only 19 women in Parliament right. when she was first elected.
Wow.
There is a sisterhood now in Parliament. There's 220 of us. Again, Jackie Smith, when she was elected in 1997, the first woman Home Secretary, and she had young children when she was first elected, and she said that she found those days in Westminster away from her family incredibly difficult, but there was a strong group of women who put their arms around her and looked after her.
Yeah.
And actually, if it hadn't been for them, she said she's not sure if she would have carried on going. The big challenge today for women in Parliament is not the lack of sisterhood in Parliament. It's the abuse that is dished out predominantly to women in politics, online, but actually also in the real world as well. The most notable example, of course, is Jo Cox's murder outside Birstall Library in her constituency in 2016, just a few days before the referendum. But the man in prison for murdering her is not the only man in prison for threats against MPs.
Yes.
The Labour MP in Lancashire, Rosie Cooper, there's a man in prison for plotting to kill her with a machete. In total, four people have been imprisoned for threats against Luciana Berger. And in the 2017 election, research was carried out that showed that women received something like four or five times as much abuse online compared with men standing for Parliament. And actually, if you were a black woman or you were a Jewish woman, that abuse was even greater. And so Diane Abbott, the abuse that she receives is off the scale as her race, as a woman of colour, interacts with her gender.
Yeah.
Same for Luciana Berger. Luciana Berger, of course, left the Labour Party because of the trolling she received from Labour Party people.
I mean,
but without the support of the leadership didn't get behind her.
I mean, it's effectively driven her out of Parliament. Effectively, she's an MP now as a result.
Luciana and I got elected at the same time.
Yeah.
Very good friends. And it's heartbreaking to see her leave Parliament.
What can be done?
Well, I think a range of things. Party leaders, and that goes for my party and the Conservative Party, must take a much tougher attitude and a much stronger response on calling
out. Better leadership.
Better leadership, absolutely.
Without question.
The Labour Party have got big problems with anti-Semitism. The Conservative Party have got big problems with Islamophobia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a state for the Labour Party to be in that we are regarded by many people, and I think rightly so, as a racist party. And that is a source of huge shame to me and my party. And there needs to be stronger leadership from the parties, and this the anti-Semitism and the Islamophobia and people with those attitudes, there's no place for them in our political parties.
Yes.
And they should be kicked out without a shadow of a doubt. I think that the social media companies have also got a responsibility.
Yeah.
I talked to people like Luciana and Jess Phillips and Stella Creasy and Diane Abbott about the abuse that they have received online, and they report it to the social media companies and it stays there. And then it gives permission for other people to say similar things. And when you look at the sort of abuse that women receive, not only is there more of it, but actually it's of a different nature.
Mm.
It's much more violent.
Yeah.
And it's much more sexual. I interviewed Theresa May when she was still Prime Minister for the book, and she described it in a way which I thought really made sense to me and really cuts through. So there used to be the bloke in the bar sitting on his own in the corner muttering into his pint or half pint, and everyone would ignore him and think he was a bit of a misfit. And now that man posts something on social media and people start following him and they retweet him and they like him. And then he thinks, well, lots of people feel the same way. I'm not on my own here. There's a lot of people who feel like I do. And they feel then more empowered to carry on saying those things. And then it bubbles over, doesn't it, into what we see in the real world.
The problem, of course, is it drives people out of politics and it stops people from coming into politics in the first place.
And it's the same in all walks of life. Why aren't there more women? Why aren't there more women in the boardroom? And why aren't there more women in politics? Well, first of all, are they attracted into that career? Now, there's a record number of women standing at the last election.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. The second thing is, do they stay there when they get there? And at the last election, what you saw is a number of women who were standing down at a very early stage in their careers. You'll never know what they could have gone on to do.
Yeah.
Luciana Berger, she re-stood, but she lost. Yeah. Only been an MP for 10 years. My friend Gloria De Piero, but actually on the Conservative benches as well. Nicky Morgan, Heidi Allen, who was a Liberal Democrat by the end of her time in politics. Both of them cited in their letters of resignation the abuse that they'd received, and they weren't willing to put up with it anymore. And, you know, both of those women had still a huge amount to give. Might not agree with everything they did in politics and the way they voted on everything, but they were clearly, you know, people of character, with vision and ideas and charisma, and they're no longer MPs, and we'll never know what they could have gone on to achieve.
Well, the only way we evolve our thinking is we talk to people whose ideas we don't agree with as well.
And as I say...
That is the only way we change.
Yes, and I feel that more strongly, you know, than when I got elected for the first time in 2010, and partly because, you know, we're exposed to it. And some people say, oh, well, you know, when you get elected, you get co-opted and you're, you know, part of the elite. But actually, you know, you're exposed to MPs from different parties and from representing different parts of the country.
Who have just as passionately held views as you do.
Absolutely. And actually, the motivations of most people who go into politics are honourable. They want to make change for their communities, and they want to make change for the better. We might have a different view of how to do that. You know, I believe to get the most out of people, we need, you know, to empower them through strong public services, to ensure that they're paid a decent wage, etc. You know, there are other people who say, well, actually, if you lower taxes, people have more money to spend. Yeah. And actually, that's a valid debate.
Yes.
And there's somewhere in the middle, I think slightly to the left, others will think slightly to the right, but there's a debate to be had. And it's your point as well, Chris, about you need strong oppositions to be able to have that
well,
debate.
That's a nice segue to my final question. So we're going to have an optimistic last question. So looking forward to, with the start of a new decade, looking forward to 2030. You'll have been 20 years an MP, in government for six by that point. What are your, apart from the in government for six by 2030, what are your hopes, fears for the next decade for politics?
My fears are that the divisions in society widen, that Brexit makes us poorer as a country, but also less influential as a country. My hopes are that we can bring people back together again, that there is now a realisation that actually many people who voted to leave were sending a stronger message and a bigger message than that. They wanted to have their voices heard.
Yes.
And that politicians now have heard those voices, have heard them loud and clear, and are now going to put in a proper response, ensuring that there are opportunities in every town and city and village and region in the country, that that people have opportunities to thrive in the communities and the places that they live, and that no one is left behind in society in a way that I'm afraid has been the case for the last 40 years, really, since the deindustrialisation that started in the early 80s.
I mean, I certainly hope, as a northerner who has only ever worked in London, I certainly hope, whether it be Labour or Tories or both, are able to rebalance our economy, certainly away from keeping a successful London, but having a more thriving and vibrant
and
north
it will be
of the
good
country
for
as well.
The
good
whole
for everybody.
Country.
Good for everybody.
Because it's not healthy to have so much power and wealth concentrated in one place. And there are real challenges in London. You know, if you are on a lower or middle income in London, it's incredibly hard to get a house. And then you've got places in, you know, perhaps in the, particularly in the north of England, but also coastal towns, where there's been a hollowing out, where people are moving away to seek those opportunities, where people want to stay, but there's nothing worth staying for. There aren't the jobs and the opportunities to stay for. So it'd be good for the whole country, and I hope will help heal some of those divisions.
Now we're going to go to our Leadership Dilemma segment. Farah, my producer, has been gathering some leadership questions. So let's see what we have to contend with today. Farah, what have you got for us?
Yes, Chris, we've had a lot of questions sent in to us. Our first one is, I've recently been promoted into my first real leadership role. As a female leader in a male-dominated industry, what advice would you have for me and how I assert my authority?
Well, the first thing I would say is just to be authentic. There are so many different types of leadership, and you've got to be yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to be consistent and people aren't going to know where you're coming from. So you have to decide how you're going learn to approach this role. And don't change who you are because you've got a new role. You've got this role because people believe in you and think you can do this. So do it in a way that's authentic to you.
I can't do better than that. I think that leadership, you know, if you spend your time thinking about all the things that make you different or all the things that you might not quite know the answer to, you're not going to fulfill the potential that you obviously had by getting there in the first place. But don't feel you have to know all the answers. I always think one of the most powerful things you could say at any point, frankly, is I don't know. You know, don't be afraid to say I don't know the answer, I don't know everything. And I think sometimes leaders need to feel like they pretend they do. I actually think they definitely do in politics, interestingly. I think that more politicians should say, I've changed my mind, and more politicians should say, I don't know. I think it's a real bugbear of mine that but both politicians and the press, there's nothing the press love more than catching a politician who's changed their mind. And I want politicians who've changed their mind. But anyway, that's a whole separate debate.
Our second question is, I work in the voluntary sector and on campaigns. How do you successfully galvanise people around a cause and still get stuff done?
As I said in the beginning of my conversation with Chris, motivating volunteers is quite different from other forms of leadership. And I think when I set out in the campaign to save the local swimming pool, I knew that my pleading with the local authority and with the central government wasn't going to cut it. And so what I had to do was build a coalition of people who were going to bring that story to life. And so I found people who learnt to swim there, and it's a Edwardian pool that had been open for over 100 years, people who used to go dancing there when it was a dance hall in the winter and a swimming pool in the summer. I got all the local schools involved to write letters to the council, to do a march to the swimming pool, with make their own banners, because they all had their swimming lessons there. And actually they made the argument much more powerfully than I did. And so I think that if you're in the voluntary sector and it's about campaigning, you've got to think of how you can bring the story to life and build that group of people who can really tell a story.
So to have retained your seat in a northern seat, a Brexit seat when you were a Remainer, you must be a fantastic campaigner. What's your secret?
I think one of the things you need to do sometimes is to change the conversation that you're having with people. And Boris Johnson and the Conservatives wanted the last election to be all about Brexit. And actually, there was much more at stake. And so not only did I try and turn it onto other national issues, but it was about who do you want to be your local MP. So if you turn the conversation to who do you want to represent you, who's going to fight our corner and ensure that the voice of Leeds West is heard, well, people knew that I could do that, and I did it with, you know, a huge amount of energy and determination to get a good deal for our community. And so sometimes I think it's about trying to change the conversation about what people are looking for and what people are voting on.
I think it sets also a great example of what I think leadership is about, which is getting stuff done. That's what you've done.
Yes, I remember when I first stood for Parliament and I was knocking on doors, and I managed to get my mum to come out campaigning, and it's not really her forte, but anyway, she came out, and this one guy said to her, politicians, they're all the same, they say one thing, they do another, they never deliver. And my mum said, not Rachel, she's my daughter, and she's been the same ever since she was little. She says something, she just gets on with it, she doesn't care what the... And this man, by the end, I think he didn't know what to say.
Yes.
So, unfortunately, I haven't managed to get her out much since, but she was my hidden weapon in that election.
There you go, the tiebreaker. If I'm really struggling, I'm going to get my mum out. Rachel, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks so much for your time. I know you're really busy, and thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
And unfortunately, that's the last episode of the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast Season 1. We will be taking a short break now while we record episodes for Season 2, and the podcast will be back very soon. In the meantime, please spread the word, tell your friends and family to check out the rest of the No Bullshit Leadership Podcast and, of course, the book, and take care of yourselves until next time. Thanks and goodbye for now.